as we do this, we see precisely that anything that is a thing comes and goes.
Mm.
And so back to that important question of who am I? If everything comes and goes, then all we can possibly be is self-knowing awareness equal to space.
Dan, I can't think of any better way to start my Monday morning than to talk to you right now. I mean, just your bio says so much about you. I studied with a monk for 5 years, meditated 29,366 hours, and then married a neuropsychologist. Your mission, normalize well-being for 1,000,000,001 people. I mean, we could spend, and we might spend, the whole hour and a half just talking about that bio alone. But when I read it back, it's like, normalize well-being for 1,000,000,001 people. What is the extra one for?
Just so I can say I normalized well-being for over 1 billion people.
That makes sense.
Just a little joke to myself.
I love that.
Keep it light, you know.
Yeah. So 29,366 hours. That's very specific. How did you come upon that number? And what did that teach you about the nature of your own mind?
Hmm. Well, everything, to answer the second part of the question. That process answered every question that I had since I came online as a 4-year-old boy asking why. And so we'll get into all of that. That number came from a conservative estimate of, first of all, the amount of formal practice that I did, sitting practice, but then also taking into account that a big pivot point for me was that my first teacher, the monk who I studied with, he was very keen on everyone dissolving the boundary between meditation and non-meditation. Heard this before? I see a smile.
I love the phrasing of it.
It's everything. It was everything for me. He said, if there's something good about what you're doing when you sit down to meditate, well, why not do that all the time? It's just the mind. The mind is with you everywhere. So then I kind of made an estimate of what that transition looked like in terms of hours, to then where, when I had dissolved that boundary in the timeline, which was shortly before I met my wife in 2019, that was when I stopped the counter.
I see. Because then a new counter started.
Well, I mean, people ask me these days, do you meditate? And I say, really, I have two answers to that question. Either I'm meditating all the time, or I'm never meditating at all.
If I have this correct, it's that life will present you with the places your mind goes, and you will see yourself more clearly by virtue of interacting with the world, and you will evolve by virtue of just being. And how does that sit with you?
It's really interesting. When we look at a timeline of ourselves, we plot that story chronologically, and we say, a year ago I was like this, this, and this. Today I'm like that, that, and that. There is this appearance of a journey of growth, of evolution occurring. But the great flip that I made, and that I spend most of my day encouraging other people to make, is to put it all on its head, to see actually what we're doing is we're subtracting from ourselves.
Hmm.
We're not growing, we're shrinking. We can now, we have to be careful with these kinds of ways of speaking, because this isn't to say that we can't speak about growth, that we should never speak about, hey, I evolved. Right, it's still useful to use that kind of language. And when we're telling our story, we have to use dualistic language, right? We have to talk about past and future. But in terms of our direct experience, which is what the whole spiritual path is about, we see that actually all we've ever been doing is subtracting anything that we took ourselves to be. We're saying, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not that. I used to do this, now I don't. Used to do that, now I don't. Used to be this, now I'm not. And that looks like growth.
Mm.
But all that's happening is we're coming more and more into alignment. We're uncovering, revealing our natural good qualities, which are our birthright.
Yes. So this is something I was so excited to talk to you about because, oh man, there's so much here. So I started to go to church. And one part of church I didn't understand was not sitting with me or that I couldn't understand. And you helped put language to what I was not in alignment with. And that is the concept of original sin. And I would hear this original sin all the time. And then I realized by reading your writing that I never understood original sin or what it meant. And in your words, let me try to bring them up real quick. But it became clear to me as I continued speaking with my monk friend that I'd been brainwashed by my culture. There was no malice in this. People just didn't know better. The most problematic belief was the one at the root of all my dissatisfaction. It's at least as old as Judaism, and it's now so entwined with Western culture that it's a part of our collective identity. I was born broken and must fix myself. That's original sin. But this new teacher of mine, had been immersed in the wisdom of teaching an entirely different culture. And he asked me, what happened if I dropped that belief? What if, he asked, the opposite is true? What if you were born perfect, but then convinced that there was something wrong with you? And that is the belief that I hold as true. Because when we look at a child, when we look at someone who is literally 6 months old, we don't say, your heart knows that person isn't imperfect in any way. That person is beautiful and loving. And everyone can look at that with clear conscience and say, this is so beauty, the potential that this person has, that this baby has. And why are we convincing ourselves that we are not that baby anymore? That is the question. And thank you so much for writing that because it spoke to where my current understanding of reality is in beautiful, beautiful ways. And I'll link it down below for people who want to check it out.
I'm glad you got so much from that, brother. Yeah, it was pivotal for me to even hear an alternative presented, to even hear, hey, that's just one way of thinking. You can go for original sin if you want. You can believe in that if you want. But there's another way to think. Or indeed, the greater invitation, what happens if you stop thinking at all? What happens if you stop thinking, stop believing? What's the truth then in your direct experience? Before anyone ever told you anything.
When you look at a baby, you get that sense, right? They're directly operating with that present moment. And they're directly, it's love. It's just, it's and love. You could feel love, right? From just being in the presence of somebody who has no preconceived notions of life. And
a baby will lock eyes with you.
Yeah.
You ever experienced that?
Of course.
And there's nothing there, right? They're not thinking, what does this person think of me? They'll stare you down for as long as you can bear to look at them. And I can remember a time when I used to think, how crazy is this? When I used to catch myself thinking, I wonder what this baby thinks of me. Am I acceptable to this baby? Can I bear to lock eyes with this fresh soul, this boundless open awareness represented by this baby that has no ideas about anything? Here's me running all my ideas, right? Now, what would happen if I stopped all those ideas running? Well, I would just lock eyes with that baby. And as I continued on my journey, this would happen. I would have kind of rare encounters with infants, and I found that I could hold their gaze for longer, and it is nothing but love.
That's really beautiful. And on that point, you have a tweet here, how to read minds in three steps. One, get quiet enough that your own mind isn't constantly distracting you. Two, get genuinely curious about the person in front of you. And three, get still and open your senses. The details you'll see in facial expressions and body language will shock you. And what's so beautiful is that this is true not just for a baby. This is true also for every human being who is any age. You can really see the beauty in that human being if you stop your own scripts from running. What is this person going to think of me? What is, am I doing the right thing? It's like, just be in that moment. And instead of us talking from the soapbox in some sense of like, this is the experience that I actually feel. Like, what can someone do who's listening right now and is like, what are these guys talking about? Like, how do we even get to this point? Right? So I want to make it practical for the person who's listening as well.
Indeed. So there are many different levels at which we can approach this. Someone who's struggling to get quiet in the presence of another could just take up a formal meditation practice. That would be the classical advice, right? Learn to watch your breathing and in time be satisfied doing nothing but watching your breathing. And then take that practice out into the world. I like to recommend that whatever practice we're doing seated, we begin in our distraction-free environment. Then we take that practice on a walk in a secluded spot. Then we go out in a public spot. And then finally, conversation would be really the final boss, right? Human beings as phenomena are so seductive, right? They seem to demand so much from us in terms of reaction that it really is kind of the final test, really. If we can remain completely present in the presence of another human being, maybe several, I suppose we could say would be another level still, right? But human beings are very interesting. They do seem to demand these reactions from us. And of course, all of these run on a bunch of old scripts that we've been running, as we've been talking about, these thoughts, these beliefs that we've been running for all this time. That's one way to approach it. And that represents the more developmental model. You can hear there's a timeline there, brother. The way that I prefer to work with students these days is I give them a simple instruction, the most simple and most profound spiritual instruction I ever heard, which is to rest naturally without seeking or describing anything. This comes out of the Tibetan tradition. And then all I'll do with that student is I'll work with them to find out where their stash of attachment is. And that's where we do our work together.
Mm.
Now, because people come to these practices in 2023 with so much prior experience and knowledge, someone's done Headspace, another person's done Sam Harris's Waking Up, another person's hung out with a teacher in a monastery, another person's, you know, there's endless options for spiritual practice these days. So what I figured out was the only sensible place to begin is at the end.
Mm.
Begin with that most profound instruction and then see where the resistances are and go to work there. And then maybe the correct prescription is a sitting practice. Maybe it's a walking practice. Maybe it is that we can skip right to working in conversation and remaining present. So that's the way I like to do things these days.
I love that. That sounds very helpful. And, you know, you mentioned people as the final boss and conversations with people as the final boss in some sense. What I found fascinating is that the closer that person is to you relationally, the more triggering people could potentially be. And I found that a stranger does something wrong, you know, there's no problem. But if my dad does something wrong, oh, that says something about me, or that really hits me in some way. And I've realized that the better I get at dealing with my family and the better I get at approaching my family with love and the better I get at embracing all the situations that happen with family, the better and more free I am. Have you also found that to be your experience in yourself and working with people?
1,000,000%. Yeah. I'm reminded of a wonderful moment from a teacher named Ram Dass, who you might have come across. Yeah. Maybe you heard this. He said to at least one crowd on at least one occasion, if you think you're doing well on the spiritual path, go spend a weekend with your parents. And you know the line?
Well, that line came about because he had spent all this time, I believe, in India, meditating every day. His dad picks him up from the airport and he gets mad at his dad. And he's saying to myself, oh my God, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a weekend with your family. He's like, he realizes that when his dad picks him up from the airport, how much it was really bringing up old patterns, which is a fascinating thing in us. And it made me, when I was reflecting on this and thinking about this story and thinking about this idea, I was curious, what were the blocks in your path that were most difficult or took the longest for you to uncover, see, and become free from?
The major one was fear of intimacy.
Wow.
I discovered a major blockage here. I had felt for almost 30 years, I discovered, that I felt that I was unworthy of affection, specifically from women, specifically in seeking a romantic partner. And I had been down all kinds of roads, working at this on different levels. For example, I studied the psychology of attraction and I tried going out and meeting women and doing that whole thing. And that uncovered some minor blockages, but my whole purpose for going down the spiritual path in the first place was to strike at the root. I really felt like, hey, if I can take out one of the bottom layer of the house of cards, then it all comes tumbling down, right? Why be working up here when I can just deconstruct the whole thing? So no matter which of these avenues I went down, I was always drawn back to my mindfulness practice because I felt that that was where I was going to find that bottom card. And I did. One day I was sat in meditation. This was a formal sitting practice. I was practicing the Buddha's Anapanasati method, just beginning with watching the breath and then getting into the whole body, the feelings, the mind. And completely by surprise, I had an encounter with little Dan. Wow. With my 5, 6, 7-year-old self, standing at the edge of my school playground, watching the kids play a funny little game, which I discovered is unique to the UK. This game is called Kiss Chase. And the kids will run around, essentially it's tag, but the kids are trying to kiss each other. And, you know, maybe they'll land one on the shoulder. Maybe they'll get a cheek if they're lucky. Of course, they're imitating behavior that they've seen. Little Dan didn't know that. And what I discovered in that encounter was that little Dan had not seen his parents be affectionate to one another. He'd never seen that behavior modeled. Mm. And so looking at these kids, imitating that behavior that they'd seen, I was very confused as that youngster. So essentially what followed is kind of like a lucid dream. As my 30-year-old self, I then approached my 5, 6, 7-year-old self, took him aside, and said to him, this is what's going on here. These kids are doing what they've seen their mums and dads do. And you've never seen your mum and dad do that, have you? And we had that conversation. And it turns out this is a well-known phenomenon in the Zen tradition. It's called purification in the Zen tradition. The spontaneous arising of some painful memory, or what we would perhaps these days call trauma, and the shining of the light of new wisdom upon that old memory so that it can be released. And so I had that conversation with little Dan, gave him a big hug, told him everything was going to work out fine. And that was where I released my fear of intimacy, released my feeling unworthy with regard to romantic relationships. And it was a few weeks later that I met my wife.
Wow.
So it worked.
That's wonderful. And why was that story so particularly charging to you?
That was an issue that followed me around my entire life. From that moment on the playground, in my youth, I had gone on to stack assumption on top of assumption about myself, my degree of attractiveness to the opposite sex, whether or not I was worthy of love and affection. And that had influenced my interactions with women, which of course then gave birth to new assumptions. And so I was in this chain reaction. And so it was that even though I had some success with women, I had a wonderful relationship throughout my 20s before I met my wife. But there was a lingering sense of unworthiness throughout that relationship and throughout other relationships that I'd had, dates, etc. There was always this lingering sense that I was somehow getting away with it.
What do you mean?
And I wanted to eradicate that. Well, that the female attention that I received, I was not actually worthy of. That I was somehow just scraping through to get the success that I had found. Right.
Yeah. And that all released when you basically gave a hug to your 6-year-old self?
Yeah.
And how did that feel when it released?
Like great relief. Great relief. That burden that I had been carrying around for those 30 years. And again, we're back to the timeline here, punctuated by the present moment of direct experience in that meditation. So there was this sense of relief. And though I could say it was a burden, some heavy emotional baggage that I'd been dragging around for 30 years, what that really was in more direct terms was a mental process that I had been running all of that time, that I was running in that moment, that I simply stopped running.
Yeah. Yeah. You let go of the script.
Yeah.
And what I've realized is that so much of what I'm doing often is just getting people to recognize and be aware of the scripts they're running that are causing them suffering. And I'm sure you feel a similar way. And so let's say we're not there to ask someone questions or to serve as that mirror for someone's beliefs. What should someone be asking themselves to understand the scripts that they're running that are causing them harm?
Who am I? Is the fundamental first and most important question that anyone can ask themselves. And yogis have sat with this question for years and years and years. This is a question that I found had as many answers as I could give to it. And it was only when I stopped answering the question in the abstract and simply relaxed into, oh, who am I? Right now, who am I? What is my experience of myself right now? So that question is fundamental and deeply rewarding to contemplate. Beyond that, what do I care about? This is another great question for someone to ask. What do I care about? What do I hate? What can I not stand?
That is what we sit with.
It's a big one, right? What would I change in the world, given limitless resource and energy? Quite a telling one, right? What do I love? Who do I love?
I mean, someone could just have a whole field day with just those that we mentioned. If you just took a journal and you removed yourself from technology for a single day and you put out every single question that Dan just said, you will be in a better spot on that day. And there is something remarkable about that. and special that you can change your direct experience just by virtue of understanding yourself better and asking questions to yourself and really thinking and sitting with the answers.
100%. And indeed, if any of our listeners do decide to run that exercise, I'd love to hear from them.
This is like something I'm excited to do after this is like, let's just get into the program, because you think you've asked yourself these questions and then it's like, there are new answers that could pop up. There's new understanding and it's a never ending well. And it's so exciting. Someone asked me, you know, what do you look for in podcast guests? Like why do you have certain people on the show and not others? And I said, what I'm really looking for is someone to be in alignment. And how I figure out in alignment is, if I gave that person $1 billion, how much, if at all, would they change their behavior?
Which is such a great test.
And it's funny because I invited you onto the podcast, but I didn't even know that you had tweeted something like, today would be no different than if I had $1 billion in the bank. When did you make that realization for yourself?
So I made a transition in April of this year. I spent 20 years as a professional musician. I would perform a lot and I would teach a lot on drum kit. And I loved that job. There was so much that was good about it. But once I discovered the mindfulness stuff, not just in terms of the changes that it affected in me, but what I'd seen it do for other people as well, I knew that this was the direction that I had to take my life in. So I made that transition slowly. And in April of this year, I closed that old business. Wow. And since then, I've simply been waking up with a deep desire. It's difficult to put words to. I just wake up ready to do good, to do things that are mutually beneficial. Right? And the mutual part is really important here, because I think a lot of folks get caught up in thinking, well, if I want to do the spirituality thing, I have to shave my head, divorce my family, run off into the woods. We just don't have to do that anymore. We just don't. And so I get up, I do what effectively from the outside looks like a work from home job, I guess. I mean, it's my own business, you know. And it just so happens that that's around mindfulness and these deep questions that we've been talking about. And that is the most deeply aligned thing I've ever done. See, I thought that playing drums was aligned. I thought that that previous career, certainly when I was a teenager, there was pretty deep alignment. But what I realized later was these deep existential questions that I'd been trying to ask, they predated my interest in music by many, many years. 7 or 8 years. Wow. My earliest memories as a 4-year-old boy are of asking why. Sound familiar?
Wow. Yeah, so it's funny because a lot of times we could think we're in alignment, but we're actually operating from something that has just been found at a later point in life. Do you think that that's related? That when we start doing something is related to how in alignment it is with our soul's purpose?
Would you repeat that, brother?
Absolutely. Do you think that when we start doing something is related to how in alignment it is with our soul's purpose? In other words, if someone starts playing golf at 1, does that make it more in alignment if they start asking why at 7? Do you understand the question?
I think so. I'll begin an answer and you can stop me if my understanding isn't complete. I think it can go both ways. I think that there are cases where a youngster gravitates towards something that there is an intuitive affinity with, and they have the support around them to make that their life's work. Amazing. If we could do that for all children, we'd be living in a utopia.
Yeah.
It's really all we have to do where kids are concerned. That Their capacity for learning is so astounding. And maybe we'll get into school and how much I have to say about that. But I think it can go the other way as well, where a lot of children are coerced into something that perhaps their parents like, or an uncle or an aunt likes. And it's interesting to consider, this is just coming to me now, in a sense, that's dangerous in proportion to how good the kid is at what's being forced on them. If they're good at it, which everyone would think is something to celebrate, they're actually going further and further down the wrong path. Now, they could still be doing something that's of great benefit, right? I'm reminded of another Ram Dass story, actually. It's a bit tangential. Maybe we'll come back to it. On the other hand, maybe you have alignment and the kids and the parents and whoever it is that are taking them down that path is the right direction. Another thing to consider in this conversation is that when we really strip down our affinities, core values, talents, our natural gifts and aspirations, what I've seen is that they all reduce to mutual benefit.
Mm. And why is that?
Because this is our nature. If we look at the largest sample size that we have, the monks, of which there have been hundreds of millions by this time, when they get quiet enough, they become kind.
It is so remarkable to me how the more intelligent a species gets, the kinder it becomes. That's been my experience, at least. Has that been your experience as well? What a poor leading question on my end, by the way. I agree with you. but I
actually do.
Yeah. Why do you agree with it?
Well, I'll tell you. My wife and I were watching a wonderful series on Netflix not long ago called The Last Kingdom, set in medieval England, Dark Ages England. And I said to her several times throughout that show, how the fuck did we get through this? It was barbaric, man. It was the value of a human life was so low. And so indeed, as we've become more intelligent, and indeed more wise, then our quality of life has raised exponentially, I would say. Yeah.
And someone listening to this might want to better understand how to be more in alignment with their soul's purpose. What would you tell them by virtue of helping to get to that place of the quote-unquote right path?
I would tell them to rest naturally without seeking or describing anything. Any trace of us trying to find it is to go in the wrong direction. And this is the beautiful elegance of this instruction, is we're saying, I completely surrender. I completely surrender to my nature. I'm not interested any longer in contriving things, answering these questions about who I am in the abstract. I want to know who I am when I don't say who I am. And that's where we're going to find our purpose. And it can look like anything. Can look like anything, right? So this idea of mutual benefit, one person I often look at as an example is Phil Jackson, the famous basketball coach.
Right. Great book, linked below. Yeah. 11 Rings, I believe it's called.
Yeah. Who was deeply into spiritual philosophies and practices and effectively used that to entertain the world at the highest level. That's what he did. That's why we have these high-level sports fixtures being played out. That's why these athletes are going to so much trouble. It's because people want to be entertained, right? And so although it doesn't necessarily look as directly helpful as, say, a surgeon, And I had this crisis when I was playing drums, thinking, what's my purpose? What's my contribution? And I figured out in the end, oh, I'm an entertainer. So that when the surgeon finally gets some time off and decides to come out to the bar and cut loose, then there's me on my drums providing the entertainment, and I help that person to relax. Then they can go back and perform surgery the next day feeling refreshed.
That's, yeah, that's beautiful and well said. One thing that I've been playing around with as well is, what if your purpose is just to be here now? Like, I think that is like, that reduces it to such a point of like, obviously it's the Ram Dass book, but it's like, wherever your consciousness is fixated in that moment is your purpose, because where else is it fixed? It could be fixated in a billion other places. And by virtue of it being right in front of you, that means that give that moment as much meaning, as much purpose, as much life as you possibly can to make it mutually beneficial in some way. And and I think there's really something to, like, you can never go away from your purpose because you're there. It's like, it's a remarkably beautiful thing. And really sitting with that and understanding that has really helped me. You know, one thing that I'm maybe like curious about is how so much meditation seems to leave people feeling peace in some sense, but there's also a lack of enthusiasm or energy that sometimes I ask myself, do I really want to go down this road if it robs me of the thing that I love so much about myself? Have you...
Good news. An authentic spiritual path will only generate more energy.
Mm.
More enthusiasm. We just fall more and more in love with what's going on around us. Mm. My struggle in terms of energy these days is keeping myself in bed. I typically wake up around 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning ready to go.
Wow.
And sometimes I'll just get up. Other times I'll say, no, calm down, Dan. No, come on, let's get some more sleep. You could get to the desk later and start talking about this stuff because it's just so exciting. And, you know, I've ended up talking about this stuff. So it's, in a way, it's kind of meta, right? We're talking about like how to find the purpose. This is the means of finding the purpose. And this happens to be my purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the case that everyone who gets into this stuff ends up teaching it, although it's a wonderful thing to do. I went through a period of great withdrawal in my journey. That was greatly worrying to my family. They remarked upon how withdrawn I became. And there were periods of low energy. This is largely documented in the Buddhist tradition as disenchantment. It's said that the practitioner will become disenchanted with the world. Right? We'll see that, hey, all the things that used to give me pleasure just don't do it for me anymore. I can't get gratification from anything. And this opens up what many practitioners have come to call the dark night of the soul, the meaning that the phrase has been kind of co-opted from the Christian tradition. In the Christian tradition, it meant that, I think there was one particular famous Christian, though I forget who felt that he had been forsaken by God. And that for all of his prayer, he had been left alone. And that was what he called his dark night of the soul. Well, it's been co-opted in meditative practices in this kind of modern movement of wisdom to mean when we just can't get our kicks from any of the shit we used to, but we haven't quite figured out how to relax enough to uncover that deep well of spiritual joy that is to replace our old means of gratification.
How did you integrate that?
I experimented for a long time. So I used to be deeply into video games as a kid. That was my escape. That was my gratification, my distraction. And at some point, just stopped being interested. I wasn't getting that fix. anymore. So I just experimented with it over time. I would try a new release that came out and I would see if there was anything in it for me. In the meantime, I'm continuing my practice. I'm relaxing more and more. I'm uncovering that deeper spiritual joy that is to replace the gratification. In other words, I'm raising my baseline satisfaction such that the promise of something like video games is less attractive. It's only when there's a gap between those two that there's an issue. And actually what I've been able to do pretty effectively with students more recently is make sure that we kind of develop both in proportion so that as they lose interest in worldly pursuits, that baseline satisfaction is being raised in proportion so that they're supported. And it's quite a simple thing to do mechanically. Where I've come to now, brother, is every now and then I'll enjoy a video game as a work of art. As a work of art. And then I'll put it down. And I'll go back to whatever I was doing before.
And it's like, it's so interesting how we find these things that are bad or demonized or things that we shouldn't do. Like video games is one example. Scrolling the feed is another example. It's like, what if nothing was wrong with doing the activity and instead what was wrong was our judgment of doing the activity? Mm-hmm. Like really mm-hmm. sit with that. Like all the things that are going on in the head of the person who is constantly like, why did I do this? Why did I do that? I'm wrong for doing this. I'm such a bad person for... It's like, but also like, what are the benefits of video games? What are the benefits of scrolling the feed? What are the benefits of drinking alcohol? Literally everything that you think is wrong or that you believe I'm such a bad person for doing... What if those were your greatest gifts in some way? And mm-hmm. really sitting with that question has helped unlock, it seems like, a lot for people I've asked it to. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And it actually ties in very nicely with the Buddha's deeper teaching on karma. Everyone knows about good karma and bad karma. We talk about this in popular discourse. The Buddha actually said that those two kinds of karma are exceptionally rare. So it is very rare that something is all good or all bad. The most common type of karma, he said, is actually mixed karma. There's good and bad in everything. And then indeed, how we engage with that thing, how we interpret it, how we use it, is everything as to whether we get the good or the bad from it and in what proportion. But there's a fourth kind of karma that he spoke about, and that's the karma that ends karma. Now, for the benefit of our listeners, the most direct translation we have for the word karma is action. And so we tend to think about karma, don't we, as like good boy and bad boy points. Like we're racking up some kind of deity or some great machine in the sky is keeping track. This is something my first teacher used to love to talk about. Well, we've never seen those things. It's nothing more than superstition to suppose that there's some running tally somewhere. Hmm. But what we can see is, hey, if I play video games for a week nonstop, I feel pretty fried. I don't want to work, right? Because I've hooked myself into a piece of media which has been engineered to make my brain do certain things. I'm hesitating to invoke the D word that's become so popularized, you know, because it does, we demonize certain things, and I think a more nuanced approach is wise, because for all the people who have ever tried, so few have ever been able to just shut themselves off from everything, right? We look at the monks as the example of folks who have really cracked the asceticism thing. But I've heard accounts of how whenever the monks enter someone's house as a guest, they're keeping their eyes open for dark chocolate. Because that's something that they're allowed to have. So that's kind of like their treat, right? So it's like, there's no getting away from the fact that chocolate is delicious. video games are fun, right? There's no getting away from it. So the only thing to do is to embrace it. And what I discovered was, on this journey of relaxation, for years I had a great fear, which was, if I relax, how do I know I'm not going to turn into a degenerate?
Wow.
How do I know I'm not just going to end up at the bar all day? Or taking even harder drugs? Or doing whatever my base desires push me into, in a way of speaking. So I ended up essentially playing a game of chicken with myself. I'd relax a bit. I'd see what happened. I'd get some evidence. Oh, hey, this kind of looks like pretty good. Is this the beginnings of greater productivity here? That's interesting. And then I'd snap back to my old ways of behavior. No, this can't possibly be working. Because familiarity. We love what's familiar. We're so wired to stick with what's familiar. And so I just played this game over years. Relaxing, gathering evidence, retreating, relaxing again. And what I was retreating to specifically, brother, was this typical cultural model of getting behind myself and pushing, bullying myself into action. Right? What I found at the end of that road, and what I'm thrilled to be living each day now, is I am 100x more effective than I ever was when I was split in two, trying to force myself to do things. Because indeed, who's forcing whom? It makes no sense.
There's this common theme that people have where they think if they relax, then they will become less ambitious and they will not want to be part of the external world. And if they do, they'll find some way to harm themselves. And so my question is, does peace lead to less ambition?
It leads to less ambition as we know it. It has the power to destroy every ambition we've ever created or contrived or fabricated. So for me, this was my teenage ambition to be the best drummer in the world. Wow. Right? Seemed deeply aligned at one point, and on some level it was. Deeply enjoyed my career as a musician and did pretty well. But I found something deeper. And as I relaxed into that something deeper, there was no way for that old ambition to survive. And that's what led me to the realization that, oh, my musical ambitions were something that I had... It was a layer up, so to speak. The common analogy is to an onion, spiritual practice, or more accurately, the self, as we know it, is often likened to an onion. And what we're doing in spiritual practice is we're peeling off layers. And so my musical ambitions may have been a fairly deep layer. There was a spiritual aspect to that craft. I had some transcendent experiences on stage performing music, you know. But that was a layer. It was seen to be a layer. And as that was peeled and the rest, and every, you know, my goal became, I'm going to peel that whole damn thing until I see that indeed there is nothing in the center. And what's crazy about the center of the onion, and what makes this such a great analogy, is that that space in the center of the onion is also the space in which the rest of the onion appeared.
Whoa. How did you come to that realization?
Came up with that one just a little while ago. The onion is a very common analogy because of peeling the layers and the fact that there's nothing in the center. But what I just realized recently when speaking with a student was, oh, that's space in the center, and space is what the rest of the onion exists in.
Wow. It's like it started with the space in the middle of the onion, and then it created all the layers, and then you decompressed the layers and got back to the space.
That's the basic pattern of life and the spiritual journey. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And is there any way to really understand which layer you're operating from? What are the best ways to figure out what layer you're operating from?
That tends to be seen in retrospect.
Ah.
Right? Tends to be that someone will go on this journey and then look back, as I did, and realize, oh, my musical ambitions, for example, were a layer. They weren't the center. And it's this wonderful process of just relaxing and relaxing and relaxing. The teacher who introduced me to the Tibetan spiritual traditions, which is where this line to rest naturally without seeking or describing anything comes from. This teacher is named Zhiji Rinpoche. Wonderful teacher. And she recommends that people simply rest as the appearance of whatever is arising. Rest as this person in front of you, this visual appearance. Rest as your apprehensions and interpretations of that person. Rest as the feelings in your body. Rest as everything and anything that comes and goes within awareness. As we do this, we see precisely that anything that is a thing comes and goes. And so back to that important question of who am I? If everything comes and goes, then all we can possibly be is self-knowing awareness equal to space.
How? How can that be the end conclusion of that?
It's the only common ingredient in all of our experience.
Right, right.
Everything else comes and goes. The only thread between all of our experiences is awareness. And that awareness is not a thing. We have to give it a label in order to talk about it. But it can only really be likened to space. And indeed, if we stop drawing boundaries and applying descriptions, labels, judgments, interpretations, then there is no separation between that awareness and space.
There's no separation between that awareness and space.
We begin with the assumption and or we're conditioned into the belief that we are an individual that has awareness, right? And then we say, I am aware of XYZ. This depends upon the drawing of imaginary boundaries between A, awareness, B, oneself, and C, the phenomenon that one is beholding. When we drop those boundaries, we see that there is no boundary. There is just space and these marvelous appearances that come and go within it.
This is why love feels so good, because yes. Love is the dropping of the boundaries and one person becoming another in that moment.
Yeah.
It's why laughter feels so good. You are connecting at a deep level with another being and you are sharing the moment so that the moment and the laughter and the other person, it all becomes one. And it's such a deep realization that what you are actually doing when you are loving someone or laughing with someone is connecting with them, connecting with their awareness, because the realization that you are that is happening and present in that moment. That's how it feels for me, at least, from this vantage point.
These democratizations of what I'm talking about are so fucking important. This is really my whole mission with my outreach, is to make this stuff ordinary, because it is. It's totally ordinary. Anyone who has ever laughed, anyone who has ever loved someone knows exactly what I'm talking about. Now, in order to explain it at a broader level, I have to use all these other terminologies, which often lead to confusion. Another great effort that I'm making is to make it as plain as possible. So you'll hear I don't use much Buddhist terminology, I try to steer clear of it wherever I can. Where I do, I try to explain it in plain language for the purpose of making this stuff accessible. And the crazy thing about it is it's ultimately accessible. We are all this. What's happening when we laugh at that joke? What's happening when we love someone is, again, we're back to that subtractive model. It's that we've stopped running the scripts of I'm over here and you're over there, right? We come back to our babies who just haven't even conceived of that separation. There's no distinction between self and other. And we can experience this, and it's super important that we do experience this for ourselves, as opposed to just hearing about it and taking an intellectual understanding. And this is the purpose of practice, is so that we can see and verify this in our own direct experience.
What are the common problems that people come to you with, your students? All right, is there a few that come to mind?
Yeah. Overthinking, anxiety, depression. These would be the big three, in a way of speaking.
Anxiety.
And indeed, there's essentially a pandemic around these three. It's recognized that anxiety and depression is rife, is everywhere. Now, I include overthinking, you know, overthinking and anxiety, of course, have parallels. I include overthinking because not everyone would identify as anxious. But overthinking is everywhere. Most people I encounter would describe themselves as an overthinker. If not now, then at some time in their past. These are the big problems. People tend to have a problem before they come to this stuff. I certainly did. My problem was stress. We could include stress. Now, again, parallels, you know, stress, anxiety, are they the same thing? I was so stressed out, brother, that I was in constant pain. And I didn't know why I was in pain at that time. So I went to see a chiropractor. She told me, there's nothing wrong with your spine. She said, it's what you're doing with it that's causing you all this trouble. Said, I didn't know I was doing anything with my spine. What do you mean? She said, well, you can come and see me every fortnight till I retire, if you like. It'll be expensive. I'll put you right. You'll go put yourself wrong again. I'll put you right again, right? Or she said, you can go and see an Alexander Technique teacher, and they'll teach you how to stop putting yourself wrong. And that's basically the function of an Alexander Technique teacher. Now, Alexander Technique is pretty niche. Not many people have heard of it. It's another story for another time, but the nutshell there is enough. The Alexander Technique teacher teaches people how to stop doing things in ways that harm them. So where the problem is self-created, which mine was, Alexander Technique was the perfect prescription. And what I discovered was that that pain that I was causing myself was the result of tension. That tension was the result of stress. So I took up the mindfulness practice alongside the Alexander Technique and had this kind of 1-2 punch going. All of this could be summarized for our listeners as means of relaxing. That's what I was doing for those 7 or 8 years, was figuring out how to fucking relax, because I'd forgotten. And most people have, which is the whole problem. Our whole culture is biased toward doing, right? And yet what we see is that when we learn to stop doing, our doing is so much more effective. When we're all doing, right, when we're always on, it's like a piece of music. If you imagine a piece of sheet music, right, written music, that's just all black. You try and imagine what that piece of music would sound like. That's what most people are trying to do in their lives. No rests.
So you hear that. You're working nonstop. You got podcasts in your ears. You feel like you're constantly going, going, going. What do?
You have to drop something. If your calendar is full, if you feel like you couldn't possibly find 5 minutes in the day to meditate, you have to drop something. You have to make some space. There's no other way. As long as we're on the hamster wheel, we got to keep running, right? So there needs to be some space. For me, I dropped work. I quit two bands that I was performing in, which were very dear to me. And the leaders of those bands were very good friends, and I deliberated for a while, maybe 6 months, shall I, shan't I? These two bands really also represented the whole of my ambition in music. As is the case with most careers, you know, I kind of climbed the ranks. And these were two great bands here in my local area, both with musicians and writers who themselves had links to even bigger bands. So I'm still playing the game, you know, doing a good job, climbing the ranks. And it just became clearer and clearer to me that they had to go.
How?
Until I couldn't deny it. I saw that they weren't serving my original ambition in the first place, which was creativity. Hmm. So I don't know if you know any musicians, brother, but a lot of musicians end up doing what's called sessioning. Hmm. Essentially freelancing. A gig here, a gig there, you learn the material, you show up, you do the job, you go home, maybe you never see those players again. But the lines become very blurred between what's a creative project and what's a job. These two bands that I was in were meant to be creative projects, but I ended up in the position where I was being told what to play regardless. So I wasn't getting that creative dividend. Neither was I really getting paid, as is the case for so many artists. So that was the first thing that got me considering, hey, I think I might need to let this go. But then later it was, I can't dedicate myself to this new thing that I'm doing unless I make some space. I don't have time to sit and meditate. I don't have time to do this new practice, which I had gained enough evidence at the time that I axed those two bands was when I had gained enough evidence that the meditation thing was worthwhile, that it was going to lead somewhere better than where I was at that moment. I didn't know where at that point. Something that was going on was I enrolled to train as an Alexander Technique teacher myself. And bundled on that long course was a lot of educational theory. So I was bringing that educational theory into my work as a music teacher. And so actually I found I was getting more creative payoff as a teacher suddenly than I was as a performer, which was a total flip on where I'd started, because I began just wanting to be on stage all the time and teaching on the side to pay rent. So I made this flip. I'm working on my teaching chops, applying all this great educational theory I'm learning. And that also made it easier to quit those two bands and make that space. So those are the kind of inner workings that were going on. And I think everyone's going to have to go on something of a journey. Look, no one's going to just turn around and quit their job, right? Sometimes it might be a family obligation. Sometimes it might be a friendship group. Man, I've left behind, I was talking about this with my wife the other day, I must have left behind 5 major friendship groups at this point in my life. And that's tough. You know, everyone's had to do that at some point, leave some friends behind. Just due to changing interests, changing compatibility. And these are the kind of sacrifices that we need to make at some point if we want to create more space in our lives, right? Because that sheet of music will just fill up. And if you're not conscious yourself about what dots you're putting down, everyone else is going to come along and start filling the page in for you. So we have to learn to say no. I wrote a piece on how to say no, which maybe we can link down below, because super useful. Before I'd figured out how to say no, I was at the mercy of anyone who wanted to come along and put a note on my music sheet. There they were, and they could have as much of my time and energy as they wanted, any time of day. When I met the ex-girlfriend that I was with for most of my 20s, she was shocked at how often my phone was on. She said, don't you ever turn your phone off? I said, no, I might miss a gig. Mm-hmm. I might miss some work, you know? I need it. I need that work. Got to keep the phone on. Fear of missing out. Wrote about that recently too. She said, you got to turn your phone off sometimes. This is like super unhealthy. And indeed it was. It was years beyond that point until I really figured out how much stress I was putting myself under.
Wow. Thank you for sharing all that. Very remarkable and inspiring, I'm sure, for someone listening and hearing the story of how releasing your attachment to something that you thought was the thing that would help you actually hurt you by virtue of you not even being aware that your sheet music was getting filled. So very, I really appreciate that story. I'm curious, what was the first moment you realized meditation worked?
Good question. That's difficult to pinpoint. I started with guided meditations, and I suppose early signs were that during those meditations, the teachers were able to lull me into a more relaxed state. So I would get little glimpses of relaxation, and it would feel good. And that's a good early sign, right? If it feels good in the first case, that's a good sign that we're doing something worthwhile. So that I would say was the first. It was with a teacher called David G, who has great guided meditations on all the apps. He's everywhere. Been doing this a lot longer than I have. And I would pretty religiously follow his meditations for 6 months to a year, I would guess, before I discovered Alan Watts and Ram Dass, and then started swallowing their work whole.
Well, I guess now would be a good time for you to tell the Ram Dass story that came into your consciousness before that we said we'd do it later.
Yeah, this is a wonderful story. So I suspect you're aware, brother, that Ram Dass was studying psychedelics at Harvard University. This is a little background for our listeners. This was before psychedelics were outlawed in the US. So he's doing all this wonderful research. And then those psychedelics are indeed outlawed. And, so first of all, they were outlawed from Harvard. This was before they became explicitly illegal. And he wanted to continue his research to the degree that he said at some point, well, look, I'll just be a datum. I'll just be something for everyone else to study, right? I leave my position at Harvard. You can have it. I don't care. I'm too interested in what I've seen in these psychedelic experiences. And so that's what happened. But years later, someone approached Ram Dass at a talk he was giving and said, Ram Dass, I don't know if I should take LSD. What do you think? And he said, well, I'm going to need some more information. And this person said, I'm a violin player. I've been a violin player for as long as I can remember. I tour the world playing concert halls. I do very well. He said, I'm worried that if I take LSD, I'll stop playing violin. Now, Ram Dass, being wise as he was, clocked that this person probably never made an explicit choice to take up the violin. We were kind of talking about this earlier, right? People coming around children and encouraging them into something, sometimes the encouragements are perhaps too strong. Hence, this violin player had this question, which, if we take the LSD out of the picture, is essentially, if I expand my consciousness, will I continue to do the things that I do? Or is there some lurking dissatisfaction here that might have me go in a different direction? Well, Ram Dass said, look, if you take LSD, maybe you will change. Maybe you'll give up the violin and go traveling and grow a beard and meditate and do all of that. But then maybe later on, you'll see your ability to play the violin in the greater pattern of things, and you'll see its value. And he said, and if you come back to the violin at that time, you'll be a much better violin player.
Oof.
Now, the violin player said, I don't think I'll do it.
Wow.
Now, who knows what happened to that violin player following the story, but at the time, he was fearful to let go.
Yeah. I think this is why I admire people who explore their own consciousness, because it really is a journey, and it really is a path that you need to keep letting go into. And it constantly it's a choice, and it's also such a beautiful thing to witness, like the expansion of someone's consciousness, but also the understanding that it's a choice and you don't have to expand your consciousness. And what that story brought up for me was the understanding that if you expand your consciousness, it might not, you'll be might likely doing something different than what you're currently doing. But is that really so bad? Is it really so bad to be doing something different if you, the result of that is expanded consciousness? So it's so fascinating how we have a tight grip on so much of what we do. And the longer we do it and the closer it feels like to our childhood or us, the tighter it is. But really releasing that. And you've given so many good resources and so many good questions to ask and so many good things to do to take someone's fist and just open it. And really that's what I'm trying to do to the best of my abilities. Just open the fist. Be open. Open and receive mode to what is unfolding in front of you. And continue to expand and continue to release into it all.
I'm right behind you, brother.
I think you're in front of me, but either way, we're walking together.
Indeed.
I like to end these podcasts with challenges. I ask the guests for a challenge to point the listener to, or viewer, to the place in which can help them live better in some way based on our conversation here today. And it might be something you've already said or it might be something brand new. But does a challenge come to mind?
Yeah. I challenge everyone to rest naturally without seeking or describing anything. And then look to see where they can't. Look to see where it is in your life you can't rest naturally without seeking or describing anything. Maybe you find it easy when you're laid in bed. Maybe you find it easy when you're doing your favorite thing. Maybe it's not so easy when you're at work. And so there is where your practice is.
Yeah.
And indeed, that would be the time for us to have a conversation. That would be the time to go out and seek some one-to-many teachings from all the many wonderful teachers that we have access to here in 2023. I mean, we're living through a wisdom renaissance here. It's incredible. Incredible. So there's no shortage of resource. But my DMs are always open. If someone wants to talk about where it is that they feel they can't let things be as they are, then that's the beginning of our work together.
Yes. And in an attempt to translate that to an even, to a more, even another place is like, where are you triggered? Where is the place that in your mind or in your day-to-day actions that you are uncomfortable with? Because that is the place for your potential freedom if you make the choice to let it. So I am I'm so honored and humbled for your presence, your wisdom here today. I feel at peace. And I feel at peace from talking to you too. So good. Thank you so much. I really appreciate
you,
Dan.
You're so welcome, brother. It's been delightful.
Where can we send people to connect with you further?
DanGoldfield.com. Links to all my socials there. They can read my newsletter, subscribe to that, hear what I'm up to. That's the best place to go.
And on that point, why is your stuff, or what has made your stuff so beautiful?
Well, I've always enjoyed aesthetics. My wife is a great artist herself, so we have a lot of beauty in the home. I like things to look nice. It's interesting, right? I was just writing about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which you might be familiar with. So this is a good opportunity to mention that wherever we're at on that pyramid, the other parts don't go away. We could be talking about this stuff all day. We still like it when things look nice. I took my wife to the art gallery here in Bristol, UK the other day, and we just marveled at these pieces hung on the walls. So that aesthetic appreciation doesn't have to go away. We don't have to go and live in a cave to do this stuff anymore. good news. We can have the beauty and these questions answered and this kind of natural living in peace and compassion that Maslow would put at the tip of that pyramid. We can have it all.
At the top of the pyramid is self-actualization. Is that correct? Mm. And yeah. And I feel like beauty is very closely aligned to self-actualization. So it's interesting that you... It's interesting that you... Not... You don't look down upon beauty at all. You just think it's lower on the pyramid?
It is lower on Maslow's hierarchy. Yes, he places it lower.
That's it. Yeah, that's very interesting because I feel like beauty and self-actualization are very closely aligned.
Mm. Mm. Well, we certainly see more beauty in our lives from a position of self-actualization, right? Mm. The more we come into alignment, the more we're going to find beautiful stuff happening. For example, my wife's very beautiful, and I would not have met her even had I not first had that realization with little Dan, right? That was stepping up the pyramid, coming to that place of non-neediness, which is the only place we're ever going to meet an ideal partner.
That's a beautiful place to bring the conversation to a close. I'm, like I said, I'm so grateful for you, and I'm so honored to spend the time with you and discuss some of these ideas, and I'm excited to continue following your... Dude, your writing is incredible. I was really diving deep last night, and it's... I mean, let me close off with a quote from you or from one of your pieces, which is, "The simple truth of enlightenment. When my teacher's teacher was asked straight, 'Are you enlightened?' he replied, 'I don't know if I'm enlightened. I only know I'm not dissatisfied.' What more could you want? Think about it. What would your life be like if you weren't dissatisfied with anything? In the absence of dissatisfaction, your true nature is revealed, and it's one of contentment, clarity, calmness, and effectiveness." Dan Goldfield, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, brother.